Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome to Outlook. I'm Stella Roberts and this edition is being recorded on Wednesday the 27th of March 2024. Coming up we have part two of a piece about teddy bears in fiction and real life, read by Elaine. Nigel has been investigating diamonds and Ali has been looking into the world of folks you might come across at bus stops. Keith brings us part one of an article about Winston Churchill, and Dave invites us to a sing-along. We end with Nigel reading us a famous poem suitable for this time of year. Now we review. We also have our usual features, news from the Resource Centre, sport and postbag. But firstly, we review the past week's news, read by Peter and Nigel.
Look News.
Officials have confirmed the pay dates for people in receipt of benefits over the Easter period when there are two bank holidays. The Department of Work and Pensions and HM Revenue and Customs has issued information with Good Friday falling on March 29th and Holy Saturday on the 30th, Easter Sunday on the 31st and then Easter Monday, of course, on the 1st, April Fool's Day, of course. Benefit payments due to go in on any of those dates will instead land in accounts this Thursday, that's tomorrow as we record now, March 28th. These changes will mostly affect universal credit, where payments are tied to a specific date of each month, along with state pension if people normally get it on a Friday. From April, the payment rates of all benefits will go up by 6.7% and the state pension getting an even bigger rise of 8.5%. Now, the Easter payment dates, the normal payment dates when money will be paid in, on the 29th of March will be on the 28th. The 1st of April will be on the 28th of March as well. The 6th of May will be on the 3rd of May. And the 27th of May payment will come through early on the 24th of May. And the DVLA has also issued its call centre opening hours for Easter, which are Thursday 28th normal hours, Friday 29th of March closed, Saturday normal hours, Easter Sunday closed, Easter Monday closed as well, but customers will be able to use online services throughout the Easter period.
The DWP may owe compensation to large numbers of women after failing to inform them properly about changes to the state pension age. The Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman said the lack of adequate information from the DWP to women over changes to retirement age is unacceptable and people must be held to account. The report comes after years of campaigning from WASPI, Women Against State Pension Inequality Campaign. They have complained that the changes shortchanged women and have been fighting for almost 3.8 million women whose retirement has been affected by the change to the retirement age. The Ombudsman said, "The DWP has not acknowledged its failings nor put things right for those women affected." The report went on to say, "Because of what the DWP has told us during this investigation, we have reason to believe it will not take steps to put things right. Complainants have also told us that they doubt the DWP's ability or intent to put things right. Given the urgent need for justice, we are presenting our report to Parliament. We are asking Parliament to intervene and identify a way to provide appropriate remedy. We think this will be the quickest way to put things right." The UK's National Ombudsman has made a finding of failings by the Department for Work and Pensions in this case, and has ruled that the women affected are owed compensation. The DWP has clearly indicated that it will refuse to comply. This is unacceptable. The department must do the right thing, and it must be held to account for failure to do so. Complainants should not have to wait and see whether the DWP will take action to rectify its failings. Given the significant concerns we have that it will fail to act on our findings, and given the need to make things right for the affected women as soon as possible, we have proactively asked Parliament to intervene and hold the department to account. Parliament now needs to act swiftly and make sure a compensation scheme is established. We think this will provide women with the quickest route to remedy.
A huge Chinese company is reportedly on the verge of signing up to build the UK's biggest gigafactory in Coventry. Eve Energy, which makes electric vehicle batteries for BMW, is said to be in exclusive and advanced stage negotiations to build a facility near Coventry Airport. It is set to invest billions of pounds into creating what would become Britain's biggest factory of its kind. The large-scale battery production facility would reportedly have capacity for up to 60 gigawatts per annum, enough to power 600,000 electric vehicles. A deal could be signed within weeks, as talks are said to be in an exclusive and advanced stage. Sources have said that the company, which is among the five biggest EV battery makers in the world, has made a multi-billion pound commitment in a letter to Chancellor Jeremy Hunt. The investment rests on hundreds of millions of pounds in UK subsidies, likely to come from a £4.5 billion pot of aid for key manufacturing industries, such as the automotive sector. The paper reports that Andy Street, Mayor of the West Midlands, has been key in the negotiation process between the joint venturer Eve and the Chancellor. Only 18 months ago, Eve signed a contract to supply BMW with large cylindrical batteries for its electric cars in Europe. The Chinese headquartered company built its first gigafactory in Europe in Hungary last November. The news comes as the project has been given a £35 million boost to get it off the ground. This cash, which is through the West Midlands Investment Zone, will see an initial sum spent on highways and infrastructure works around the site and prepare it for the factory to be built.
Plans for a futuristic tram system in Coventry are reportedly facing serious government questions over whether the scheme should go ahead. The viability of Coventry's Very Light Railway project is reportedly in doubt after government officials are said to have questioned whether it was worth the money and rejected a bid for cash to fund it. They also reportedly queried whether Coventry was the right place for such a scheme, with Birmingham reportedly being considered instead. As a result, plans for the cheaper alternative to trams face, at the very least, years of delay. A bid was made for £36.8 million in February 2023 by the City Council, only for civil servants to reject it. Now it is believed that the scheme, which a business plan reportedly shows would cost £189 million in total, is struggling to get cash. The Council has criticised the government over the outcome, pointing to the billions spent on HS2. However, the government says that it has already approved £15 million to support VLR testing. Yet hopes of opening the first route in Coventry by 2025 appear forlorn, with 2026 now the earliest expected date. Councillor Jim O'Boyle, who has been the public face of the scheme, said, "The only thing that's holding us back is not us, and it's not the private sector. It's the Department for Transport, because we've got to go through their hoops and their bureaucracy." The Department for Transport said, "It's essential that we consider and scrutinise business cases to ensure value for money for the taxpayer and ensure rigorous testing of the technology is carried out to deliver a service in the future." Very Light Railway's strategic outline business case and the minutes of a Department for Transport meeting about the project were reportedly discussed on February the 6th. The BBC said civil servants raised queries about whether VLR was good value for money. The BBC says multiple issues have been raised by civil servants. The DfT reportedly rejected the business plan and instead said VLR should progress as a research and development project. Such a switch would reportedly require a new funding process. Through it, the VLR scheme would have to prove it would work in practice in order to get access to government funds of £40 million. It's reported that the next step is for the vehicle to be tested on a so-called demonstrator track. And on top of the £15 million in government funding VLR has been handed to date, a further £11 million is required to pay for the demonstrator.
Coventry leaders have demanded £4 billion on day one of the next administration to stabilise local government in a move to tackle the pressing challenges confronting a local government. City leaders are rallying behind a manifesto put forth by Key Cities, the national network representing 27 urban centres across the UK, including Coventry. The manifesto, which enjoys cross-party support from representatives, demands immediate action from the next government to address the funding crisis gripping local authorities. At its core is a call for an infusion of £4 billion in funding to be allocated to local authorities on the first day of the new administration. Leaders advocated the necessity of reforming the current system of fund allocation and for grants to be distributed based on the city's current tax bases and pressing needs. The manifesto emphasises the need for devolving powers to local authorities, enabling them to address crucial areas such as fair funding review and council tax reform, social care funding, housing and homelessness, and the transition to a net zero economy. Rebecca Long-Bailey, MP, co-chair of the Key Cities Network, said, "With councils up and down the country in a state of crisis, it's imperative that the next administration takes decisive action to stabilise local government and ensure local communities have access to the services they need and deserve. With cross-party membership, Key Cities is an authoritative and unified voice for UK cities. This manifesto shines a light on the major issues affecting our urban areas and offers practical recommendations to remedy them."
Multiple arrests were made in Coventry in cases linked to everything from robbery to drug dealing and shoplifting in a day of action. Officers swooped across the city as part of the sting, aimed at tackling serious youth violence, robbery, antisocial behaviour and drug dealing. As a result, they arrested a total of 20 people over various offences, including theft of motor vehicle, domestic abuse, drug dealing, robbery, harassment, shoplifting and theft from a motor vehicle. They also covered the roads to carry out a number of traffic operations. Working with Coventry City Council Trading Standards colleagues, officers also swooped at a number of shops. They say that they seized large numbers of illegal vapes. Plain clothes and uniformed officers were also tasked to the streets of the city centre to patrol in robbery hotspot areas. All of the action formed part of Operation Advance. Sergeant Dean Stew of Coventry Police said, "We have had a number of officers out across Coventry, a really intensive day of activity across the city, where we have executed a number of warrants based on community intelligence. We've delivered a number of road policing initiatives, so we've had our traffic colleagues out dealing with people who've been using their vehicles illegally, and a good number of arrests based on intelligence that the community has sent through to us."
Poverty levels should not affect which Coventry roads are chosen for repairs, councillors have said, as some criticise work priorities. Members of the Conservative group hit out deprivation data being used in the process of the council deciding its works programme. Coventry roads and pavements are in the UK's top 20% worst off areas now get an added score when ranking those in need of repair, a report this month said. Opposition leader Councillor Gary Ridley said he was astonished by this at a full council meeting on Tuesday last week. Tory Councillor Jackie Gardner also said she was genuinely shocked at the move, which she said means roads in deprived areas will be resurfaced before roads in less deprived areas. She called it some kind of woke effort to spread deprivation fairly. "Roads are used by everyone, and everyone deserves to travel on them safely," she added. She said roads should be mended based on their condition alone, and if there are so many needing repair, money should be fairly distributed across the wards. She added, "It sends a message to the council taxpayers who have worked hard and avoided the deprivation pitfalls that affect other citizens that their highway safety is not as important as those that don't pay the council tax and live in more deprived areas. I call on this council to ditch this outrageous policy and give every ward their fair share for the highway from the highway budget available, because this side of the chamber values the dignity and highway safety of all citizens equally. but the Labour side of the chamber defended the move. Deputy Cabinet Minister for City Services, Councillor Gavin Lloyd, said the list of deprived areas is set by national government. We work on first worst, simple as that, he added. Cabinet Member Patricia Heatherton also stressed that they stick to government guidelines. Data from the government on roads in the worst off areas nationally have an added score, but it doesn't make them take them to the top of the list, she said.
The Home Office has announced that passport fees are going up next month. People will need to act fast if they want to escape the rise in prices. The cost for any online applications for people aged 16 and over will be £88.50, up from £82.50. And even young travellers aren't left out. Those under 16 will have to part with around £57.50, up from the current £53.50. This increase also affects postal applications and those sent from outside the UK. People have until April the 11th before the changes kick in, but keep in mind they still need Parliament's approval. Just last year, passport fees were bumped up about 9% in February. The Home Office said, these new fees will help ensure that income from these applications better meets the costs of delivering passport and associated operations, reducing reliance on funding from general taxation. The government does not make any profit from the cost of passport applications. The fees contribute to the cost of processing passport applications, consular support overseas, including for lost or stolen passports, and the cost of processing British citizens at UK borders.
A key part of Coventry city centre will soon look more like it did in the 1950s. A makeover for the balconies in the city's main shopping area will go ahead after plans sent in by the council were approved last week. It means panels made to look like wood will cover the balcony terraces at the upper precinct and buildings in Broadgate Square. The public area was built in the 1950s and revamped for the City of Culture Year. This latest move is part of the finishing touches in the bid to make the architecture stay high quality. The cladding is made of a composite material and said to be easier to maintain than wood. Just one of the buildings in Broadgate, the Mercier Lodge student block, still has real wooden cladding. The rest was either replaced with metal or removed. But this cladding is said to be in a poor state, and it is unclear if the panels are original or were a later replacement. The new covering is said to be insect and rot resistant and have a teak colour to look like the area did decades ago. The council's application also specified that the cladding will look like the original hit and miss batten cladding of the precinct in the 1950s, as seen in old drawings and photographs. Wooden match boarding that is Grade 2 listed will be replaced as part of the scheme, according to a council planning officer's report. Their assessment said that while plastic is not an ideal replacement for wood, its longevity and easier upkeep ultimately won the council's conservation team over. It will provide some uniformity to the group of buildings and bring improvements to their appearance, they added. Plans do not affect the Grade 2 listed buildings' overall importance, and officers said they recommended it goes ahead.
Pete Chambers, the driving force behind Coventry Music Museum, has been crowned as Visit England's Tourism Superstar 2024. Pete, a volunteer and the museum's director and curator, secured the highest number of votes from the public. On hearing he had won the award, the music fanatic and journalist said, "I'm absolutely delighted to be Tourism Superstar 2024. It makes all the hard work so worthwhile, although I do love what I do anyway." Councillor Jim O'Boyle said, "It's brilliant that Coventry has such a rich musical history, and we're equally delighted that we have an attraction as incredible as the Coventry Music Museum. It's something our city is truly proud of, and its success is testament to the energy, creativity and talent that runs through Coventry, qualities that Pete has in spades." The Tourism Superstar Award is a yearly competition that celebrates the work of unsung heroes who work within the tourism industry. Andrew Stokes, Visit England director, said that the Coventry Music Museum is a magical place and Pete is at the heart of it. In the Coventry Music Museum, he has created a magical place for music lovers to connect with the region's rich contribution to England's musical heritage. His relationships with local musicians have brought unique exhibits to the museum, which also draws domestic and international visitors to the wider area. Pete will collect his award at the Visit England Awards for Excellence event on June the 5th at the Rum Warehouse at the Titanic Hotel in Liverpool. The Music Museum is at 80 Walsgrave Road and is open Thursday, Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sunday 10 till 3. Admission is £5 for adults, with concessions £3 and children under 15 free.
Coombe Abbey Hotel has been named the best in the West Midlands at a prestigious award ceremony. The venue, a 12th century former Cistercian abbey, was praised by West Midlands Tourism Awards judges for warm service, supporting local suppliers and its commitment to becoming more sustainable. The abbey claimed the Gold Award in the large hotel category at a ceremony at the National Exhibition Centre in Birmingham. It will now go forward to the Visit England Awards for Excellence 2024, competing against hotels from across the country. The hotel, which is owned by Coventry City Council and operated by No Ordinary Hospitality, is known for its landscape gardens designed by Capability Brown. It has also become a popular wedding venue for couples across the West Midlands. Ron Terry, Group Operations Director of No Ordinary Hospitality, said, "We're absolutely thrilled to have won this award. Staff throughout the organisation have worked extremely hard to provide the best possible service while implementing a range of new initiatives designed to build on Coombe Abbey's reputation as a sought-after, unique place to visit. The hotel serves medieval banquets, themed Christmas and Mother's Day and tribute nights experiences, which have proved popular with visitors over the past 12 months. Last year, a staycation package was launched, allowing guests to explore all the hotel has to offer over a two-day stay. A new farm shop-style Abbey artisan market has also been launched, offering fresh local produce, snacks and hot drinks. Coombe Abbey Hotel picked up the same prize at the West Midlands Tourism Awards in 2020. This year's award saw 35 of the region's top attractions competing across 14 categories.
Outlook News.
Thank you, Peter and Nigel, for reading the news. Now to give you the sunrise and sunset times for this week. It's getting light about 5 minutes to 6 a.m. and sunset is at 6:30 p.m. So lots of light now. Most importantly, don't forget this weekend, the clocks go forward 1 hour from 1 a.m. on Sunday the 31st of March, which is also Easter Sunday, of course. Hugh's in the studio with us now, bringing us news from the Resource Centre.
Thank you very much, Stella. Just a note on those clocks. We know a lot of you have talking watches and clocks at home. If you struggle to reset the time, then we are here at your disposal the next time you're in the centre. Just talk to Heather or me and we will magically and very quickly, with any luck, set your clock to the right time. Isn't it nice, though, that we've got a bit more daylight, I have to say?
Absolutely.
Very pleased about it. It's always sort of my favourite time of the year because it feels more positive. Right, few things going on this week. Yeah, many of you know, will of course know that we have a wonderful creative writing group here at the centre, and you will know that they a few years ago they produced a book called Who Turned Out the Lights. Now Jess Eastman, and who runs the group, and Richard Warren, who helps her to do so, have worked really, really hard over the last number of months to produce an audiobook version, which is the first time that we've ever produced an audiobook. So it's been done in conjunction with the Criterion Theatre and with an organisation called Media Mania, based in Coventry. And so we will be launching, publishing an audiobook version of Who Turned Out the Lights, which is all about the people's experiences of sight loss, as written by the Creative Writing Group, And that will be launched on the 6th of April. So, we're going to have a launch event down at the Criterion Theatre. We've been doing a lot of marketing support for it recently, or developing that so that we've got lots of good things to put forward to promote the audiobook. The event itself is an invitation-only event anyway, so only people involved directly with the Creative Writing Group or the will be invited there, as well as other bigwigs and dignitaries. We've got the Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress coming, for example, and Vic Minette. However, as soon as that date has passed, you will be able to buy the USB version. So if you're listening to this on a stick that you put into a machine, same kind of stick, so you'll be able to get it here. If I recall, I think it's a fiver, but anyway, it will be available to buy. And if you're a little more technically able, you can download it from an organisation called Bandcamp. So you can go online and find it and download it. We'll have a link on our website as well, so you'll be able to grab hold of it. It'll be a bit cheaper that way, because we haven't got to pay for a USB stick. Can't remember what the price is off the top of my head, but is a minimum price set, and then if you fancy adding on a little donation, everybody, I'm sure, would be delighted for that. Anyway, so I'll give you a bit more information about that in due course, but if you're excited about that, then you'll have just a little bit longer to wait. Now, that event, as I say, is taking place on that launch is taking place on the 6th of April. That day also, I mentioned this last week, is the Coventry Book Extravaganza, which takes place at the Belgrade Theatre from 10:30 until 4 o'clock. And it's all sorts of independent publishers and bookshops and second-hand books. Large print books, I know, will be available in great quantity, as indeed will audiobooks. So if you want to go and see a different range of audiobooks to buy, then that is very much a place to go. Now, I mention it again because I had a conversation with our very own Amy Clennell the other day as she came in, and she has been working on a project of her own, and she has been working with Ian Loughlin, who I've also been talking about recently, because he did the Peter and the Wolf narration for the concert organised by Annette Ball. And so Amy has been working with Ian on a project. She's been a little bit secretive about what that project is, because that too will be launched at the Coventry Book Extravaganza at the Belgrade on the 6th of April. I don't know what time, so really what you need to do is get there at 10:30 and stay there until 4. But she's really excited about it. It's been a long time in the making, this project. There's all sorts of really big name people involved. So I'm looking forward to finding out a bit more about it. I will tell you. But if you want to go down and support Amy, and maybe just get involved in some books down there, you'll be very welcome. And Amy would of course love to see you. And I'm sure whatever it is that she's done, she's written a terrific book of poetry already that some of you will know, whatever it is, I'm sure will be available for people to acquire as and when. Now, I told you last week that we had our showdown table delivered, and so we did. And it has, it's big. Can I tell you that? It's big. It's a lot bigger than I thought it was. Fortunately, we have the room. We have the room for it. So what was the old dining room of Boston Lodge is henceforth the showdown room. Now, this showdown table is a legacy piece of equipment from the IBSA Blind Games that took place in Birmingham last year. The whole idea was, once the games were over, that they would be distributed around various charities or organisations in the country so that they could start off a proper showdown league for the UK. It's a game that's very popular in North America, well, Canada, and Northern and Eastern Europe, but not so much in the UK. And it's a great game. It's a cross between sort of air hockey and table tennis. Fast-paced, furious, everybody plays it blindfolded. It's a deep table, so there's a ball with a bell in, and you've got to try and get it in the other person's goal. It's a lot of fun. I've had a go. This table, having been used in the games, was then put into a warehouse. They were all stacked up on top of each other, which was really unfortunate, because it has come with a little bit of damage, so the playing surface is not as stuck to the base as we would like it to be. It's all going to be repaired with the people at British Blind Sport who've been coordinating the whole project. They knew that there'd be some damages to the table, so they've got they're prepared to get in there and sort it out. It's not irreparable damage, not by a long chalk. But we are going to set up a have a go day, and we're looking at sort of mid to three quarters of the way through April. We don't want it to clash with other things. It might be the end of April, so we'll get everybody who wants to come along. It'll probably be on a Saturday, and just to basically bash the ball around a bit and have a go and start playing and getting to know the game. We think we've identified a volunteer who is going to be coaching. For people who want to take it a bit more seriously, who want to join the team, the Coventry Comets, but we're going to get him trained up a little bit as well. And he's a very good chap. He's been a badminton coach for years and years. This is not badminton, but you know, but it's. I imagine that some of the same principles will apply. Certainly, the talent for coaching. So we're looking forward very much to that group getting up and going. Watch this space. We had in reception, we had a giant Easter egg, and that was available. You had to pick a football team. It's the competition we do every year. Kindly given to us by the Lions. Pick a football team, pay a quid, and one person wins. And the person what won this year, as we drew it yesterday, was Stinder Joel. So Stinder comes along to Tai Chi and bowls. So congratulations, Stinder. A kilogram of chocolate. And you'll need to do all that Tai Chi and bowls quite a long time to get rid of the effects of a kilogram of chocolate. But there we are, a kilogram of chocolate is sitting here waiting ready for you, and we'll see you at Tai Chi. Okay, and that, dear friends, is it for this week. So just to remind you, I'm not here next week at the centre, I'm at Urm. And so Joe will be sitting in. Well, in that case, the next time that you get this, that you get the talking newspaper, you will hear my voice. So that's all right. But I won't be in the centre next week. So after that. So okay. That's it. Joe will be back next week in the centre. Cody's off for another week, Easter week, so everybody will be back, hopefully, the week beginning the 8th of April, pretty much. Yes, and that's definitely it now. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Hugh. Now we have Sarah and Nigel with this week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely listeners, and I really do value every one of you. So let's try and convert a few of those people who say, oh, but I don't like sport. I try to make sport fun. And if I can find a bit of humour, or let's be honest, a bit of sarcasm to bring out, I will. Now, I tried to do this week's episode without mentioning football, but I just can't. So here goes. Leamington's 1-0 victory against Reading United has firmly put them back in the playoff zone for promotions. They're currently fourth in the Southern League Central. Meanwhile, their Southern League Central local colleagues, Stratford Town FC, also beat Long Eaton. But I don't actually have score for that because I'm afraid, although I ploughed through their Facebook page, I couldn't find it. Now, I'm not going to bother to spend a moment on the England versus Brazil match last night, other than to say, Gareth, I'm sorry, but if you and your men are serious about lifting the trophy in July, You've got to play better than that. I found it dire. However, in contrast, my second team, and I'll be honest, if they qualify, they will be in my first team, Wales, took on Finland. Now, this was a semi-final qualifier for the European Championships. They hadn't made it out of the initial round robin, but they did well enough to play in the playoffs. So they now play two of the other teams similarly placed. And in the semi-final of that, they took on Finland. Now, there'd been much talk of strikers like Pukki, who used to play for Norwich City and now plays for somewhere in the States I've never heard of, and particularly the Finnish goalkeeper, who was said to be an absolute world beater. Well, I'm afraid Wales did beat him and soon ran him to the sword, and eventually ran out 4-1 winners. They were very fortunate, actually, because the draw had placed both of their matches, that is, both that round and the final round, at the Cardiff City Stadium, which is not the Millennium Stadium, but it's where Cardiff City play. So they have home support, and we all know what the Wales, what the Welsh supporters are like. Right, so on Tuesday, now I'm actually recording this on Sunday, which is rather unusual for me, they take on Poland, with one of those teams to go through to the European Championships. Hopefully by Wednesday I'll be relearning the Welsh national anthem in Welsh, like I did the last time they qualified for the European Championships. Now, as there was no sort of league football per se in Coventry, CWR turned its attentions to the rugby football club, and Coventry were away to Hartbury University. Now, apparently in the 10 times they played Hartbury away, they'd only won twice, and the last one was a 3-0 narrow squeak. Anyway, wow. Didn't Cov pile it on, and they ran out eventual winners 47-17. Though I have to say, the real determinant of this whole match was the strength of the wind. When some of the kickers were kicking, whether it was over the, it was to the crossbars or just a kick, the wind was either blowing it back or lifting it many, many metres further than it should have gone. But anyway, this leads Coventry second in the championship. They were thought to be going to be in third, but then Doncaster Knights pulled out a blinder and drew with them pesky Cornish Pirates to mean that Pirates lost their ascendancy, and Coventry are now second. So moving on to other sport now. Recently it has been the British Gymnastics Championships. Now I'm not going to run down a list of names who you probably haven't heard of doing events that, well, you're familiar with by now because I talk a lot about it, but that may be of very little interest. However, particularly noteworthy is Max Whitlock, who aged 31, which isn't exactly ancient, but it's a veteran for gymnastics. But he came back after a year out to win the British Championship on the pommel horse. Now, to put that in context, he has been to the Olympic Games 3 times, so his first games was back in London, 2012, and each time he's come back as champion in that event. Come on, Max, make it a 4. I'm sure you can. talking about the Olympics, as I just briefly was, and it's 124 days away, as I record. So it's about 120 days when you're listening to this. But there has been a proposal from whom I haven't got the details or the inclination to find out, to be truthful, to have a similar event, but where athletes are allowed to compete having taken drugs. In fact, there's almost an expectation that they will have taken drugs. What do you think of that? I mean, the argument seems to be that, well, it's about pushing the body to the limit. But to me, anything that pushes the body to a limit, to the limit, but needs you to take drugs, which have probably got pretty nasty side effects. A lot of drugs do have now. You know, to me, it just doesn't seem like sport. Moving on to another sport which is in the Olympics, tennis. Now, this week has been, well, this week and a bit of next week, has been the Miami Open. The bad news is Emma Raducanu had to withdraw because of a back injury. However, she says it's only a minor one and she hopes to recover. Well, Emma, so do we all, but back injuries don't tend to really be that minor unless they're respected. But on the positive side, both Cameron Norrie and Sir Andy Murray are in the third round, as I record. They're probably out by the time you listen to it. And Katie Bolter is through to the fourth round. So the Brits are showing good progress and quite a lot of depth as well, as we're now building up to Wimbledon. Yes. Now, you may have heard this on the news, but I'd actually written this before I did. A British woman has become the first woman to ever finish the Barclay Marathon. The what, I hear you say? Well, it's actually an ultra marathon. It's 100 miles long and it includes an ascent of 60,000 feet, which is the equivalent of climbing Everest twice. Not really my sort of cup of tea, but whatever floats your boat, and that doesn't float my boat. As I said before, she was the first woman to complete it since it extended to 100 miles in 1999. And when I say complete, it has to be completed within a time limit of 60 hours. So she was running uphill and down Dale, etc. for 59 hours, 58 minutes and 30 seconds. Oh no, not my cup of tea at all. And I'm sure there's, well, shall I just put it this way? The name of the park where it's actually based is called Frozen Peaks, and it's in Tennessee, if you're interested, for next year. Chris and Claire, I'm sure it's one for your do list. Anyway, well done to Jasmine Paris for that feat. And I have to say, I did laugh when I read on the BBC website she slumped to the ground with exhaustion on finishing. I think I'd do that after a few hours and I'd only be walking. And finally, now sticking with athletics, and this is only a proposal and it would only work, to be honest, in the top class competitions. There is a proposal to change long jump. You know, that event that for years and years and years, probably since time began, it's been about running as fast as you can up to a white line or a piece of rope or a piece of plasticine or a board or a whatever. and jumping into a sandpit. So it's been really a combination of matching skill at takeoff on this particular place and your run-up, so that you just get to that line before it's ready to jump. And then, of course, the long jump. Well, it is proposed to increase its spectator ability, if there is such a word, to make it a long jump zone, so that the runners can just run as fast as they can and take off anywhere in this up to 1 meter zone. And the beginning of the jump would be measured from that point. To me, that just defeats the object, but who am I to say? Now, I'm going to pass back to the studio, to Nigel now, to update you on the Australian F1. Bye from me. Have a great week.
Well, last week's Grand Prix in Australia saw Max Verstappen's long run of wins broken. Not by any fault of his own, but by brakes catching fire in lap 3, forcing his retirement. But this wasn't an opportunity for Mercedes, rather the opposite, with their dismal run of non-competitiveness continuing, with Lewis Hamilton retiring from a lowly ninth position with engine failure on lap 17, and George Russell involved in a horrendous crash in the penultimate lap while only in seventh position. The real winners were actually Ferrari and McLaren, with Carlos Sainz just a couple of weeks after surgery for appendicitis and his Ferrari teammate Charles Leclerc taking the top two podium positions, with Lando Norris and his McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri taking third and fourth. Sergio Perez and the other Red Bull only managed fifth, so does this herald the start of Red Bull facing some real competition from Ferrari and McLaren? We'll just have to wait and see. No doubt Max's run of wins is welcomed by Max and the Red Bull team, but it's not good for the sport or the spectators, who long for some competitive, exciting, close racing between the top teams. As for Mercedes, it certainly doesn't look good for this season, but Lewis's move to Ferrari next season might see some changes.
And you'll have an opportunity to see if Red Bull really have competition at the next Grand Prix in Japan, on Sunday the 7th of April. Thanks to our sports reporters. Now let's go over to Dave to hear the latest from your postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag, where you, not me, have the responsibility to fill it. And it was very nice of you, Elizabeth, to say how well I joined all the messages together and presented it. Thank you. And Edwina has been giving you helpful tips week after week. Now, one listener took on board one of the tips and had a spring clean of her clothes. Here's Edwina to speak to you, Doreen Hilton.
I'm starting today with a very special message for Doreen. Thank you so very much for your message to me. I was thrilled to receive it, because sometimes I've thought, I wonder if many people do take much notice of what I talk about on the programme. Obviously, you take a lot of money, and you actually took action too by deciding straight away after reading about choosing brighter clothes and keeping your self-esteem with what you wear. You promptly went upstairs and cleared all your old clothes out of the wardrobe and presented them to the charity shop at the resource centre. You have moved on. You are looking after yourself. It means you feel better about everything in your life, because you have now made yourself feel a better person, a more presentable person. So very well done for taking such action, and keep up that good work. Keep your appearance and feel good about yourself. Many thanks again. It really lifted me. Take care. Love you, Edwina.
Thank you, Edwina. I'm glad you are happy that not all your advice has fallen on stony ground. And with that misquote from the Bible, that brings me to Julia's latest report. It's Jesus time. Jesus died on a Friday, so why do they call it Good Friday? He was crucified, but I don't think it hurts. When something goes wrong for me, I sometimes say, "Oh, Jesus." When he was crucified, I wonder if he shouted, "Oh, Julia." Anyway, he came alive on Sunday, so that's all right. He just went on holiday with his dad for 3 days. At Easter, we eat chickens, rabbits and lambs, all made from chocolate, or we have hot cross buns. I bet nobody knows when the first Easter egg was made. My friend Jen knows. It was 1873, and I think she made it. I think we should finish with this sing-song. I will sing the chicken song from Spitting Image in 1984. I expect my friend Dave will help. Hold a chicken in the air, stick a deck chair up your nose, buy a jumbo jet, and then bury all your clothes, paint your left knee green, then extract your wisdom teeth, form a string quartet, then pretend your name is Keith. Happy Easter, Julia. Thank you, Julia, and good question. Why do they call it Good Friday? Perhaps you can tell us. Last week we heard from new listener Jag Singh praising the one-to-one computer sessions at the Resource Centre led by John, and also praising Outlook as well. This week he talks about some ideas for the Talking Newspaper.
I recently spoke with Dave Monk, and I wanted to share some ideas for this podcast, and maybe we could expand it a little bit. But my first idea was a legal chap, so maybe we could speak to a local legal firm and give them a bit of free advertising, and just answer people's questions. It could be about disability rights, it could be about, it could be anything. It doesn't have to be about eyesight. It could be just the smallest thing that you may be a bit nervous about or not sure about, and these solicitor chaps, they certainly seem to know their stuff. The second idea I had was a money section, and you know, we can approach local businesses, restaurants or gyms or whatever, and again give them a little bit of a plug if they're prepared to offer fans of the Conch Talking Newspapers a little bit of a discount, or just let people know where there's really good deals in Coventry. I'm a big fan of getting a good deal where I can, and it always seems to be more enjoyable. And the third thing, which I really would like to volunteer myself for this role, is to do maybe like an interview, you know, hear my voice or a chapter from my life section. And, you know, so many interesting people in Coventry don't have to be visually impaired. And just a one-to-one interview where somebody from, well, I'm going to guess it's going to start with Coventry, and who knows where it could go. But we have a gentle, almost casual chat about who they are, where their journey started, what took them to where they are today. And I think that's going to be quite inspirational, because I have speak to a lot of people with visual impairments that it is easy to feel isolated. It is easy to say, you know, I've got eye conditions, my world is limited. Me, for example, I've had glaucoma since I was 6. I'm 50 years old now. I went on to have several businesses in Coventry, and I'm a property landlord now. And it really wasn't that difficult, to be honest with you. So there's some ideas which I think would add a lot of value to what is already a very, very important podcast, which many, many people enjoy and benefit from. You can get my phone number from Heather if you want, but I'd love a bit of feedback or some sort of involvement if it helps.
Well, thank you, Jag. And if you can recommend somebody who can talk about disability rights, please let me know, as I can invite him or her to come to the Monday Club, where I could record what he or she has to say for the listeners. The same applies to people with interesting stories to tell. Or if you have a suitable recording device and the means of emailing it to the engineer, you could interview them yourself. Also, if you have any firm you recommend who's done a good job, please tell your fellow listeners in Postbag. And finally, if you're interested, what's happened to Mark Wood? Mark went to spend 100 days in the Arctic on his own, carrying out scientific experiments and the goal of getting in the Guinness Book of Records for being the longest time anybody has been in the Arctic by themselves. He went via Canada to Resolute Bay on Cornwallis Island. From there he went to Polar Bear Pass on the edge of Bathurst Island, where he took the Top Gear team. He stopped in an Inuit hut with Devon and his friend Daniel, where he watched the film Oppenheimer, about a man who invented the nuclear bomb, on Devon's phone. He spoke to us last week on Radio Polar 100, outside the hut, in minus 30 degrees, where the signal was stronger, saying that he was happy, but scared about his challenge ahead. Mark did go out after the blizzard had stopped in a snowmobile and there were ice boulders the size of cars, but he found, due to global warming, there were large patches of water on the normally frozen Arctic Sea. With this in mind, he regretfully had to abandon his challenge and come home. Before he did, he came back to Resolute Bay and he took part in an interview with Joe Sills in California, who read out my email about his kindness to Edwina and his admiration from the Monday Club. So, here is Joe talking to Mark.
This is from a man named David Monks. And this is a story I didn't know about you. He says that, "I hope things improve for Mark and the Solo 100 expedition. He is a very nice, kind, and inspirational man. He's a hero to the blind and partially sighted people at the Monday Club at Coventry Resource Center for the Blind. He gave his precious goggles to a deaf blind lady because they cut out the glare and she could see things like trees." That's the kind of person, everyone, that Mark is. He never told me these stories. I didn't know any of that. This is all just feedback that I've gotten over the last few days from the podcast.
It's lovely what David wrote. He's a lovely, special guy. The guys at the Monday Club are just, well, they're inspirational to me. The first time I gave a talk to these blind and partially sighted people, I set up my projector and started to put pictures up, and this lady tapped me on the shoulder and says, that's no good, we're all blind. I was like, oh, okay.
good thinking there, yeah. You knew in advance what you were going to do, and you brought pictures anyway. That's very smart of you.
But that taught me to describe scenes. So I think I was before Everest, and I remember being on Everest, speaking to them and describing, I know I was at the North Pole, and describing what I could see around me, which made me more of a descriptive satellite phone image person, you know.
And that helps, that has helped our show, you know.
Well, after so much planning, it was a very difficult decision for Mark. And if you have a message for him, please let him know you are thinking about him. And to Wendy Paling, thank you for your recent message in Postbag about asking if you know who collects postage stamps and if you know of any stock car racing taking place on the Brinklow Road. Well, please let her know. And if you want messages to go in Postbag, Wendy, for the following week, they need to be received by the studio before Wednesday when we do the broadcasting for Outlook. Christine then sends them to me via email and I prepare them for that weekend and then I send the postbag to her. So thank you for your messages this week. We really need your input. You can ring us up with a message on the studio postbag answer phone on 024 76 717 522 and press 5 for Coventry's Talking Newspaper. So that's all from Postbag and I'd like to wish you a very happy Easter. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
As always, thank you, Dave, for bringing us Postbag. And now here's part two of Bear for Life, Lynn Benz's article about favourite fictional bears and two belonging to famous people. It's read by Elaine.
As one of the leading characters in Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, Baloo, together with Bagheera the Black Panther, teaches the man-cub Mowgli the laws of the jungle. They show Mowgli how to hunt, how to survive, how to keep peace with the lords of the jungle, and to seek refuge in the lair of the wolf. There have been several famous people with equally famous teddy bears who also deserve their share of the spotlight. Archibald Ormsby Gore was the much-loved ally of Sir John Betjeman. Who else but Betjeman would have christened a bear with a double-barrelled surname? Archie, as he was more affectionately known, accompanied Betjeman when he went up to Oxford to study divinity. He would eventually become the subject of a book Betjeman wrote for his children, entitled Archie and the Strict Baptists. Naturally, Betjeman wrote a poem about his beloved bear, who served as a silent witness to the bard's often anxious upbringing. Grayson Perry maintains a close relationship with his bear, Alan Measles. From the age of 4, Perry has worshipped his teddy bear, who he sees as a masculine character, father figure and fantasy leader with godlike attributes. Drawn for D.C. Thompson by the supremely gifted cartoonist and illustrator Dudley Watkins, Biffo the Bear made his first appearance on the front page of the Beano in January 1948. Biffo ousted its former cover star, the bird-brained Big Ego, in the process. Sporting his customary shorts and braces, the antics of the black bear cub ensured he retained prime position on the comic's cover for the next 26 years. He played his part in fighting off stiff competition from rival publications such as Mickey Mouse Weekly, Radio Fun and Knockout. As the strip progressed, Biffo introduced his naughty nephews, Cuddly and Dudley, and his special human friend, Buster. All were lovingly portrayed by Watkins, who sadly died of a heart attack at his drawing board at home in 1969, age 62, while working on a Biffo strip. Almost 75 years since making his debut, Biffo still regularly features in the annual Dandy and Beano compendiums that celebrate the combined history of the two comics. While extolling the virtues of the teddy bear, I feel it would be amiss not to mention Sooty. Yes, I know Sooty is a glove puppet, but in reality he is a glove puppet masquerading as a teddy bear, as most illustrated depictions of his character confirm. Devised by Harry Cormett, the Sooty Show first aired in 1955 and instantly catapulted the mischief-making puppet to fame. Whenever Harry uttered those immortal words, "Izzy Wizzy, let's get busy," you just knew the mayhem was about to be unleashed. And oh, how we relished every second. Poor doltish Sweep and hapless Harry were usually on the receiving end of Sooty's pranks, which frequently involved flower bombs and water pistols, and a liberal sprinkling of magic oofle dust. If we sympathised with poor Harry after receiving yet another custard pie in the face, few of us could stifle our laughter as he uttered that immortal phrase filled with resignation. "Bye-bye, everyone. Bye-bye." Do you still have a teddy bear? How old is your teddy bear? What name did you give to your teddy bear? Oh, think about teddy bears for a little while. They're such comforting little bears.
Yes, I have two teddies. One very ancient, called Simon, bought me by my dad when I was leaving home for college, and a knitted one I inherited from my late mother. He's called Tommy, and he watches TV with me from the arm of my chair. Mum had a collection of bears who still live on top of her wardrobe. I know I should find them new homes, but I don't like to think of them split up from the group. Let's hear Nigel now. He's discovered quite a lot about the nature of diamonds.
"Diamonds are forever," or so the song goes, and it's not difficult to see how the song got its title. Diamonds are possibly the most sought-after and popular gems of all times. A diamond is a solid form of the element carbon, and with its atoms arranged in a crystal form called diamond cubic. With the highest hardness and thermal conductivity of any natural material, these properties are invaluable and are used in major industrial applications, such as cutting and polishing tools. Pure diamonds are transparent and colourless. They can be very valuable in monetary terms and can often complement coloured diamonds that are created when trace elements interact with the carbon atoms during the diamond's creation. The presence of chemical elements such as nitrogen, sulphur and boron can colour diamonds in shades of yellow, green and blue. Pink diamonds are incredibly rare. Trace elements can never be found in this colour. Instead, the colour is caused by a distortion in the diamond's crystal lattice, created by intense heat and tremendous pressure from all directions after the stone's formation in the earth. This distortion displaces many carbon atoms from their normal positions and changes the qualities of light reflected by the diamond. It is this special configuration of the molecules that allows us to observe the gem as pink. Pink diamonds from the Argyle mine are believed to possess the finest intense pink. In contrast, non-Argyle pinks have a few and indistinct pink graining and are therefore usually lighter in colour. The pink graining in Argyle stones is sometimes visible to the eye under close inspection. The Cullinan diamond is the largest gem-quality rough diamond ever found on Earth. It was named after Thomas Cullinan, the owner of the mine where it was found in South Africa. In 1907, the Transvaal Colony government bought the stone and Prime Minister Louis Botha presented it to Edward VII, the British king who reigned over the territory. Joseph Asher & Co. of Amsterdam was the company chosen to cleave and polish the rough stone into brilliant gems of various cuts and sizes.
With the cutting completed, each larger stone, 9 in total, was given a number. The two largest of these stones form part of the crown jewels. Cullinan I, otherwise known as the Star of Africa, was later added to the sovereign's sceptre, ready for the coronation of George V. Cullinan II, the second largest stone cut from the original diamond, acquired the name of the Second Star of Africa, was set into the gold imperial state crown. Edward purchased Cullinan IV for his wife, Queen Alexandra. The Dutch diamond merchant kept the 96 smaller stones and unpolished fragments as his fee for cutting the original rough stone. However, the South African government acquired these stones and presented them to Queen Mary, consort of George V, in 1910, to commemorate the formation of the Union of South Africa. All 9 of the original larger stones now belong to the British Royal Collection. Myths and legends surround the subject of diamonds, including Greek and Roman. Roman literature stated that Cupid's arrows were tipped with diamonds, and Greek philosopher Plato wrote about the idea of diamonds as living beings that embodied celestial spirits. In the time of the pharaohs, 3000 BC, a diamond was placed in the middle of the ankh, a cross with a loop on top. This was the Egyptian hieroglyph meaning life. Diamonds represented the sun, symbol of power, courage and truth.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend, sang Marilyn Monroe. But I think I prefer the human kind, which is just as well. That piece was from the Chatterbox magazine. Ali's next, with a story she's written called Tales from the Bus Stop.
The one topic that generates conversation in this country is the weather. We are obsessed with it. It's like what Forrest Gump said about a box of chocolates. With our weather, you just never know what you're going to get. Abigail caught the bus to work every morning. She didn't live all that far from the bus stop. Her house was slap bang in the middle of 2 stops. If she turned left from her house and went across the road and walked a short way, she'd be at the bus stop that had a shelter and some seats. If she turned right and went across the road and walked a bit, she had a bus stop with no shelter and no seats. It really depended on the weather as to which stop she chose to go to. As silly as it was, she preferred the bus stop without the seats, as she met some really nice people and struck up some interesting conversations. Only a handful of them were about the weather, but more often than not, the conversation was about current affairs, local gossip, or the number of student halls of residences that were popping up in the city, which always seemed to generate negative comments. Chatting to people at the bus stop is a dying art. Not many people these days like to engage with strangers, and more often than not, the people you stand next to are constantly on their phones checking their social media or immersed in their own world listening to music. Abigail noticed it was usually the older generation who are most responsive to strike up a conversation, and after a couple of years of not going on public transport and seeing people again, it really felt good to talk. A couple of elderly ladies she had not seen before came to join the bus queue one day and stood next to her. They were both chatting away, and Abigail recognised their accent as being from Ireland. "Oh, ladies, I could listen to your accent all day," she said. "Which part of Ireland are you from?" One of the ladies, Margaret, told her that they were both from Cork, but had actually lived in the UK for over 50 years. And their accents weren't as strong as they used to be. And when they go home for visits, the families tell them they've gone all posh and English. Bridget, the other lady, had a soft Irish lilt. You could imagine her reading to her kids at night and then falling asleep to her soft, gentle voice. Listening to the two ladies speak and tell her about their early lives as young ladies coming over to England was fascinating. But the stories they tell about how harsh they were treated by the nuns at school was horrific. Margaret said that she still had scars on her thighs from where she was thrashed as a child. She wasn't badly behaved, but the nuns in the school were so strict that just one step out of line would result in a beating. You can tell from what they told Abigail about their collective experiences that their school days were something that they'd much rather forget. Abigail felt she could listen to them talk all day, and she discovered so much about how it was for young Irish girls who married at a young age and followed their husbands where the work was. It was a hard life coming to a new country and a new city with hardly any money in their pockets, working long hours and bringing up their kids on next to nothing. Abigail discovered that both of the ladies went into town on a regular basis on the same bus, so she'd look out for them and strike up a conversation and continue where they left off. Bridget's husband was a labourer and came to Coventry in the early 1950s, where there was plenty of work on building sites, rebuilding parts of the city that were destroyed by bombs during the war. He worked long hours, and he and Bridget had three children, all under the age of five. So she had a part-time job in a bakery and relied on friends and neighbours to look after the kids during work hours. "We worked hard, but we were very happy," said Bridget. More building projects were popping up, and Bridget's husband's skills as a builder were in demand. His pay improved, and they were able to put a deposit down on a new build property on a housing estate. Bridget was a loving wife and mother. She made a good home for all of them and looked after them well. Saw them through school and college, and two of her kids went off to university and are now working in the healthcare profession. The youngest of the three was an apprentice with a local electrician, and now he has his own business. She's also a doting granny and does not regret one bit leaving Ireland to come to Coventry, a city she calls home, and is at one with a thriving Irish community. Margaret's story was very similar. She came over with her husband, but she was the one who was the major breadwinner, as she was a nurse and later matron, and worked at the Coventry and Warwickshire Hospital, where the walk-in centre is now. Her husband, Brendan, was a taxi driver and worked around her shifts. Like Bridget, she had three children, all of them girls, and all went into the teaching profession. Margaret is a well-respected nurse, and when she retired, the hospital threw a surprise leaving due. It had to be a surprise, because she wouldn't have wanted to know about it in advance. She wasn't one for being the centre of attention. All through her life, she quietly got on with her job and didn't expect plaudits for just doing a job she loved. Margaret said that she despaired at how lowly paid the nurses are and had hoped that they'd have a decent pay rise after the pandemic, especially when so many of them were on the front line and went above and beyond to look after the patients. A lot of nurses lost their lives looking after others. Margaret was so desperate to come out of retirement to help out, but her age was a factor against it. Instead, she made sure that her elderly neighbours were okay and left food parcels on the doorstep. Talking to these two ladies on the bus was a treat. To hear about their lives, their families, their hopes and aspirations, and their take on modern life. The one thing that the two of them were divided on was social media. Bridget could not see the point of it. Posting on walls, tweeting and TikTok videos, they were like an alien language to her. It wasn't until one of her children introduced her to the wonders of the internet and YouTube in particular that she started taking an interest. She started to watch a lot of films that had been posted online about the Irish show bands, which were so popular in their day, and where most people of Bridget's generation learned to dance. Through the powers of YouTube, she managed to relive her youth and see the popular singers and show bands of the day that she would swoon over as a teen. The Irish show bands were very popular in the 50s, right up to the mid-80s. The bands were based on the internationally popular 6 or 7-piece dance band and include dance band members as well as numbers of pop hits of the day. The lead singers were gods to the young girls, who adored them. And thanks to YouTube, Bridget would dip into different films, and they brought back many happy memories of her youth before she came over to the UK. Margaret, on the other hand, was more tech-savvy. She had to keep up with the new technology because of her job. As the health service relied more and more on new equipment, the nurses had to be trained on how to use it. As a senior nurse, Margaret had to be on the ball and up to date with how to use the machines so that she could teach the younger ones. Also, like Bridget, Margaret's grandchildren were all on social media, and she liked to keep up with what they were doing. One of Margaret's grandchildren had a particular following on YouTube. She put up makeup tutorials, and they were watched by thousands of people, something Margaret was extremely impressed by. Margaret was even featured in one of her granddaughter's videos, as she did a makeover on her, and she became a very glamorous gran indeed. You can imagine the number of subjects that were discussed on the bus. And yes, sometimes it wasn't nice standing in the cold and wet, waiting for your ride. But getting on and sitting next to these two lovely ladies made all the bad weather disappear. And once Abigail sat down on the bus, the journey was a pleasurable experience. And, more importantly, she made two lovely new friends. Abigail wished more people would take time out and talk to each other on the bus. Not enough people spend time getting to know each other, and we tend to lock ourselves in our own worlds by listening to iPods or music on our phones, that we just shut everyone else out, which is a shame. Since meeting Bridget and Margaret, Abigail was determined that she'd make sure to say hello to new people at the bus stop in future, as you never know what wonderful stories you get to hear.
I quite agree with Ali about the dying art of conversation on public transport. It rarely happens as most people are glued to their phones. I do manage it occasionally though, and it's usually quite a treat. Next we have part one of a piece by Sinclair Mackay about Winston Churchill. It's read by Keith.
As a former soldier who had fought on the most ferocious, blood-soaked battlefields, Winston Churchill knew how to infuse the British people with confidence and courage. The starry lustre of his language guided the nation through its darkest days of the Second World War. Yet while he is a historical landmark remembered for indomitable will, Churchill, born 150 years ago this year, also embodied another very particular British trait, his sheer eccentricity. Whether launching into perfectly recalled music hall songs at inopportune moments, or bursting into sentimental tears over B-movies, or simply bringing cheer to crowds in blitz cities by putting his hat on the end of his cane and waggling it about in the air, Churchill consistently charmed friends and enemies alike with unstoppable sideways humour and unpredictable outbreaks of emotion. Many who met him were dazzled by his quirkiness. For instance, in the summer of 1940, after the British Army's harrowing retreat from Dunkirk across the Channel, Churchill met with the then Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery on England's south coast. Hitler's armies were just a few miles away across the Channel. Even then, the eve of the Battle of Britain, Britain's destiny on a sword edge and the weight on Churchill's shoulders crushing, he could not help being skittish. "He asked me what I would drink at dinner," recalled Montgomery. "I replied, water. This astonished him. I added that I neither drank nor smoked, and I was 100% fit. He replied in a flash that he both drank and smoked and was 200% fit. Churchill then looked out across Brighton Pier and had a sudden moment of random, misty-eyed nostalgia, telling Montgomery wistfully of how he used to go and see the performing fleas in the kiosk there. The following year, while deep in the heart of war, Churchill was staying in the country with Lady Diana Cooper, among others. The house had a private projection room. We had two lovely films after dinner, the socialite and actress told her son in a letter. One was called Escape, and the other was a very light comedy called Quiet Wedding. There are also several short propaganda reels. Winston managed to cry through all of them, including comedy. She was also present in the rocky landscape outside Algiers in 1944, when Churchill, after a conference, was driven out into the hot desert valleys for a picnic. Despite his age, 70, and his parlous health, he insisted on descending a steep, boulder-strewn slope. But the climb back up seemed impossible. With Churchill's cheerful consent, the party improvised, using the long picnic tablecloth wound round his midriff to haul him bodily back up. There were flashes also of his old career as a Victorian cavalry officer. Field Marshal Alan Brooke was present at the Prime Ministerial retreat at Chequers when Churchill decided to demonstrate what he would do to the Nazis in close combat. I was convulsed watching him give this exhibition of bayonet exercises dressed up in his romper suit, recalled Brooke. I remember wondering what Hitler would have made of this demonstration of skill at arms. The romper suit in question was better known at the time as a siren suit, an all-in-one overall to be worn during air raids when sirens wailed. In fact, Churchill, who designed them himself, had worn such items long before the war too. Some were in khaki, some in sky blue. He had a siren suit that was made of plush deep green velvet. Today we would call it a onesie. In general, his clothing always tended towards the eye-catching. He wore hats with cartoonishly wide brims, sporting one such when he met Albert Einstein in 1933, and in 1911, when he was a young Home Secretary, he turned upon the rough, squalid streets of London's East End with an overcoat trimmed with a vast collar made from luxurious fur, and wearing a top hat. In this curious costume, he dodged the bullets fired from windows by Russian revolutionaries in the siege of Sydney Street. Sometimes his extravagant clothing was a source of vexation to others. In 1942, General Dwight Eisenhower was a guest at Chequers. A subordinate had forgotten to pack his pyjamas, and Churchill offered spare nightwear. When he got off to sleep in the huge oaken four-poster bed in a room said to have been occupied by Cromwell, wrote Eisenhower's biographer Piers Brendan, Ike was awakened by a terrible dream in which he was being strangled. He was wearing one of the Prime Minister's capacious nightshirts, which had worked itself into a noose around his neck. That same Eisenhower, later US President and a grudging Churchill fan, was also beguiled at dinner when Churchill drank his soup with raucous gurglings and gave a lecture about military strategy, citing the schemes of Donald Duck.
Churchill the man, his quirks and eccentricities. This concludes next time. Now Dave has been to a sing-along in Camden where he talks to and sings with some of the participants.
Hello, well I'm speaking to you from a musical sing-along at Christ the King Camden. And it's fantastic being invited. I'm speaking to Jan and Natalie.
Hello. Hi, David.
So what do you think of the evening tonight?
Hi, David. We're having such a good time singing all our favourite songs from all the Disney, all the musicals, everything that we could possibly want to sing. I'm just worried that I've blown my voice too much in the first half when all my good songs are coming up. What about you, Nat? I really like singing Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, and I'm really looking forward to Jesus Christ Superstar. And David knows all of the songs.
Great stuff. I do like singing, although I'm a bit hoarse now.
So you all need to come to the next one, whenever it is.
Oh,
we'll find out. And yeah, David should be in a choir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There's a sign on the wall, the Christ the King, it says, "What is life without music?" Fantastic keyboard player and singer leading all the singing. So, can you say hello to the listeners, please? Just say hello.
Have a lovely time. Hello to everyone who's listening tonight.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Love changes everything, hands and faces of the sky. Love changes everything. Can make the summer fly, or a night seem like a lifetime. Yes, love changes everything. Now I tremble at your name.
I go to a bereavement group on a Friday at Allsley Church, and one of the ladies said, "There's a sing-along at Christ the King Social Club tonight, and you like singing, so it's a sing-along session, go along to it." So I did, and here I am at Christ the King Social Club for an evening of people singing along to songs from the musical. To Tim, the keyboard player and singer. Fantastic evening tonight, thank you. Do you have these sing-alongs very often?
Not that regularly, that's the first one I've done in about 6 months, so yeah, they kind of get put together occasionally, so yeah, I haven't taken it out for a while, but it seemed to work alright tonight, so.
Okay, I was speaking to a lady here, so what do you think of the evening tonight?
It was lovely.
It was
very lovely. It was nice seeing everybody having a good old sing-along to the old songs and the new songs.
Yeah, all from the musicals.
Absolutely, yeah. All from the musicals. Somebody knew something from one of the songs.
That's great. Yeah, do you come to Christ the King on a regular basis?
No, I'm visiting from America.
You are?
I am.
Fantastic, you haven't got an American accent.
I know. I think that's a good thing, isn't it?
I don't know, really, because I like an accent.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry, I can't give you one of them.
That's all right. That's fine. Whereabouts in America?
Michigan.
Michigan, oh, fantastic, yeah. How long are you here for?
I'm going back next week.
Oh, yeah, well enjoy the rest of your stay.
Well, thank you, and it was very nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you very much. What's your name?
Kay.
Kay, thank you. Nice talking to you,
very
Kay.
Well.
Thank you.
Don't you bring now from what you see.
There's about four places I go to in the daytime and also in the evening within walking distance of my house. So I wonder what there is in your area. A community centre perhaps? Okay, but enjoy yourself. Thank you very much, and that's all from a musicals sing-along at Christ the King, Cowden, Coventry. Bye for now.
It sounded like a lot of fun, Dave, and you were undoubtedly in good voice. Now here is Nigel with a seasonal poem you probably know.
William Wordsworth lived from 1770 to 1850, and this is his very famous poem, Daffodils. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretch in never-ending line along the margins of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon my inward eye, which is the bless of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills, and dances with the daffodils.
Daffodils, my favourite flowers. What a wonderful display we've had in the city this year. That was the last item on our menu for today's programme, so it's goodbye from me, Stella Roberts, and all the Outlook team. Don't forget to put your clocks forward 1 hour this weekend, and have a great Easter, everyone. Outlook will be back in a fortnight after the Easter break.